This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the briefing room with me, David Aronovich.
We didn't want to leave our land, leave our history, our friends, our schools, our house. We didn't want this.
December, Syria, the city of Aleppo. After 4.5 years of siege, the residents of eastern Aleppo were being evacuated.
We had only two choices, dying by hunger, by pain, because there were no hospitals, by lack of clean water, by lack of every kind of life there, or to leave.
But the evacuees didn't disappear on evacuation, and the Syrian civil war didn't end with the end of the siege.
It's more peaceful, but I don't know for when, you know, because any moment the bombing, the firing, the fights might be back. I hope that one day I'm going back to Aleppo, but Aleppo without Assad, Aleppo without oppression, Aleppo with free thoughts, with democratic thoughts. This is what I want to be.
In the briefing room today, I'll be exploring with experts and aid workers where the end of the siege of Aleppo has left its citizens, Syria and the region. With me in the studio here in London is Lina Khatib, head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. On the line from Geneva, having returned this week from Damascus, is Marianne Gasser, head of the International Committee of the Red Cross Delegation in Syria. And joining us from Stockholm is Aaron Lund, writer and fellow of the Century Foundation, which is a US think tank. Aaron Lund, if I could just begin with you, could you explain to us the importance of Aleppo as a Syrian city?
Well, it's one of the two big cities in Syria, the other one being Damascus, of course. They were always the poles of Syrian politics before Syria was created, even in Ottoman times, during the Ottoman Empire. They were each part of their own province. And then in the French Mandate era, the politics of Syria revolved around Damascus and Aleppo and the elites in these cities. And that was also the case after independence. And it's always been seen as the capital of northern Syria and has often been called the economic capital of Syria and the industrial capital of Syria. And it was that before the war, and known for that in Syria, and as a city, of course, of historical importance, a city of culture and trade. And now it's sadly known more for brutality and bombings.
What role did it play in Ba'athist Syria? In other words, in the Syria that came into being in the 60s when Bashar al-Assad's father took over governance of Syria?
Well, the Ba'athist coup d'etat in 1963 was, in some sense, a sort of a countryside movement. The Ba'ath Party in those days represented the Syrian countryside, which had been suppressed economically and politically by the great cities, Aleppo among them. So in the early years of the Ba'athist regimes, Aleppo and Damascus and other cities were really marginalized and pushed out of power, these traditional elites. But I think then when Hafez al-Assad took power in 1970, he tried to address this to some extent and stabilize his regime by reconnecting with some of these old Sunni Arab elite families and landowning families formerly. But he did so in Damascus mostly and not so much in Aleppo. So Aleppo was kind of left out in the cold. And that showed in the late 1970s and early 1980s when you had a wave of protests in Syria that turned into an Islamist insurgency against Hafez al-Assad's regime, not unlike what happened in the past few years, just less violent and less destructive.
That was the Hama uprising in 1982.
Yeah,
some of us will remember the kind of pictures that came out at the time. And Aleppo was part of that uprising, was it?
Yeah, today it's known for what happened in Hama, but Aleppo was also really a center of that uprising, and there was a lot of demonstrations, there were strikes, and there were protests, and there was also armed violence in and around the city. But most of that was suppressed already in 1980, when there was a big crackdown in all of Syria, but especially in Aleppo and some other places. And the government basically went in and put up checkpoints and took armored tanks and troops into the city. And that more or less ended the rebellion in Aleppo. But of course, memories of that and of the killing and of the many people who were arrested or disappeared into jails, that lingered. And Aleppo never really made its peace with Hafez al-Assad, I think. There was always, of course, support for the regime in the city, but there was also a simmering opposition. And that didn't really change, I think, until his son Bashar took power in 2000. And then sort of Aleppo's fortunes started to rise because Bashar set out to heal that historical rift in some sense with the urban elites of Aleppo. And he pointed a prime minister from Aleppo, for example. Aleppo was, in some sense, I think, re-energized economically and politically in Bashar al-Assad's first decade in power. But, I mean, there was still a lot of the pro-opposition sentiment, I think.
How did it come about that Aleppo became such an important center of the rebellion after 2011?
Well, I think one reason was that you had in Syria, during Bashar al-Assad's first decade in power, there was a social crisis. In Aleppo, those problems were compounded, I think, by free trade reforms with Turkey. They benefited the economy as a whole and they benefited the city, but they really basically swept away a lot of the small local manufacturing and sort of businesses that had survived while Syria was more of a closed economy. And now you had Turkish goods coming in, cheap Turkish goods, and just knocking that out of existence. So you had a lot of discontent, I think, in the poorer parts of Aleppo city, which is especially in the eastern part, where you had a lot of recent migrants from the countryside and in the wider countryside around Aleppo, in satellite towns and rural villages and so on. And that's really from where the uprising in the Aleppo area came. So when rebels went into Aleppo and took over the eastern part of it in summer 2012, all of those rebel groups, basically, they came from the countryside. They were the children of this economic crisis. This urban-rural conflict, which had existed historically, really took on a new importance, I think, in after 2011, where the city mostly sided with Assad and the countryside mostly sided with the opposition.
How briefly would you characterize the politics of those rebels who came into Aleppo at that point?
Well, it was a lot of different groups, of course, but the rebellion in those parts, it was virtually entirely Sunni Arab from the countryside there. It wasn't necessarily very advanced politically, I think. You had some really hardline Islamists who had their very definite ideas about what they wanted Syria to be like. But much of it was just a general desire for change. And the longer the war progressed, the more important the religious discourse became. And Sunni Muslim identity politics was basically the framework for that rebellion, I think.
And when you talk about that religious discourse and Sunni identity politics, is that what later gives rise to a degree of support for the Al-Qaeda affiliate?
Yeah, I mean, that was present from the beginning, but just on a much smaller scale. But the longer you, if you had a war where people were killed and driven from their homes and so on, then of course these hardline Salafi jihadi groups, it's much easier for them to recruit and grow. And that's what happened.
Aaron Lund, thank you for that very clear exposition. And I'll be coming back to you later. Now, joining me down the line from Geneva is Marianne Gasser. Marianne, you are the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross delegation in Syria, and you were the head of the Red Cross's part of the operation getting evacuees out of eastern Aleppo. In fact, you spent a large part of the period just before Christmas in Aleppo. How do you go about such an evacuation?
Yes, first of all, we had to obtain a minimum of security guarantees. We were in contact with armed opposition groups who were inside eastern Aleppo, and we had also several meetings in western Aleppo city with the different parties to the agreement. Also for us, what was very important, that all those who leave can leave on a voluntary basis. We would not force anyone to leave by force. I would like to mention, in the last 2 months of 2016, there was intense fighting on both sides of the city, and in particular in eastern Aleppo city, but also on the western side of the city, controlled by government forces, where there were intense fighting, shelling, and a lot of casualties. I would say for 4 years, until very recently, not one single neighborhood of the city on both sides of the front line have not been hard hit. And we had tried for many months, in 2016 in particular, to evacuate mainly first the wounded and sick. But at that time, we had not received all guarantees from all sides.
One of the things that was different about this evacuation from your point of view was that you didn't just evacuate civilians, did you? You also evacuated some of the people who'd been involved in fighting.
Our main concern was, first of all, to evacuate the most vulnerable. That means the wounded, the sick, the women, children and elderly. But the fighters were part of the agreement, which was brokered by the different sides. And we did accept, because it was part of the agreement, part of the evacuation operation, and we did accept also to evacuate the fighters.
How many people did you evacuate in that process, and how many of them were fighters?
It is very difficult to confirm, but we did evacuate over 35,000 people. The big majority were civilians, numerous children, women, and elderly, but there were, I would say, also a few thousands of fighters who were also evacuated to western rural Aleppo.
And where did these people go?
We did evacuate them from eastern Aleppo city, and we escorted them until western rural Aleppo. Thousands of people remained in western rural Aleppo. There are many villages and towns in western rural Aleppo, which are currently held by armed opposition groups.
Marianne Gasser, thank you very much indeed. Now, earlier, we spoke to somebody who was one of the evacuees from Aleppo, Abdul Hafi, an English teacher in the city. In December, he, his wife and their young daughter managed to secure a place on one of the buses leaving besieged eastern Aleppo. Abdul Hafi was on a dodgy line from the countryside, but he managed to tell us what happened on the 18th of December when he and his family got on one of those buses.
The buses moved just a little until we were in the regime areas, in the first checkpoints at the regime areas. Suddenly, they just stopped in the sides of the streets and they told us, please be silent and don't move. I will tell you the number of people who were in one bus. We were 102. 40 of them were children. 38 were women and the other were men. We didn't take water with us. We didn't take food because we thought that after half an hour, we will be in the countryside. But from 1 p.m. on Sunday until the next day, 9 a.m. on Monday, we were in the regime areas just waiting. It was prohibited that anyone go to toilet. It was prohibited. So all children should do everything on the bus, on the luggage. So, you know, the smell of the bus was horrible. And all the children were crying. The next day, on Monday, at about 8:30, Russian officers, one of them and one Syrian officer, went on the bus, asked us if we were forced to leave. We said no. He said, okay. Then he left, and they let us to leave Aleppo into the countryside of Aleppo, into the free part, the liberated part. When we arrived there, they were not responsible for us. So everyone should take responsibility of himself. So for me, I went with my family to my wife's aunt's house. Then later on, I could move to another house alone with my wife, and it was okay for me. Some people were without houses. Some of them lived for days in the streets. And by the way, exactly the days that followed our evacuation, it was so cold and the snow covered the area. So a lot of people spent this period outside without any shelter with their children.
That was Abdul Khafi, a teacher and evacuee from Aleppo. Now, here with me in the briefing room, I have Lina Khatib, who is the head of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, considerable expert on Syria. Lina Khatib, what impact did the fall of Aleppo have on the wider Syrian civil war?
Of course, the fall of Aleppo is not the beginning of the end of the civil war. It just marks a transformation of the civil war. It marks, of course, a major moment of weakness for the opposition on the ground, the different rebel groups that have been defeated in Aleppo. But a lot of these groups are not likely to disappear. They are likely to transform. They are already moving, some of them, to places like Idlib, where they are joining other rebel groups in that area. And some of the other groups that are scattered are likely to continue to fight as insurgencies as this conflict grinds on. And so we shouldn't think that what happened in Aleppo is a sign that the Assad regime has won this war.
That's very interesting, because that's exactly the way in which people have been characterising it. I mean, what as I understand it, the city of Idlib to the west of Aleppo is this sort of bottleneck into which the different armed groups have been poured, and the Syrian regime is now waiting just to kind of destroy that. But you're painting a different picture.
Well, no, I'm actually agreeing with you that the regime is waiting to destroy Idlib as well. What I'm saying is that a lot of the rebel groups did move to Idlib because that was part of the agreement in some ways. The regime actually wants them to go to Idlib because if the regime can squeeze the different rebel groups into one area, if the regime already holds Damascus and already holds Aleppo for the most part, and the opposition is mostly present in Idlib, kind of in the middle, then it makes it much easier for the regime to overwhelm them. So this has been the evacuation that we're hearing about. And one of the reasons why the fighters were allowed to be evacuated is actually part of the Assad regime's strategy for wanting to crush the opposition.
So why isn't it now just not going to be possible for the Syrian regime to do to the other rebel areas what it's already done to Aleppo?
It's highly likely that the regime will follow a similar strategy. I mean, what happened in Aleppo is not unique to Aleppo. We had in the past seen a siege of Homs, for example. The regime seems to use sieges and starvation as a strategy in order to weaken the different rebel groups. So Aleppo was, you know, one of the biggest governorates in Syria, and it was a tough and long process, the siege and the starvation that kind of was attempted as part of that. We are likely to see a similar scenario with Idlib further down the line.
So why will that not simply succeed?
Well, I mean, you have to remember that a lot of these groups, in terms of rebel groups and the people who are part of this war, have lost so much that they consider themselves to be dead anyway. And therefore, they will fight till the very end. And so to think that just because there is a military victory for the regime and its allies in one part of Syria or different parts of Syria, that this will mean that these people that had risked so much and lost so much will just accept defeat and accept to live under the Assad regime once more as the situation had been before 2011 is completely fanciful. The grievances that these people have held have grown over the years. They have lost their means of livelihood. The oppression of the regime continues. We have to remember that during the evacuation, thousands of people have been reported to be absent and missing. No one knows what happened to them because the regime is likely to have used the evacuations as a way to also get rid of some of the opponents on the ground.
Now, formally at any rate, there are at least two peace processes going on, aren't there? I mean, there's a ceasefire, and then the talks that are due to be held in Kazakhstan, and there are also the Geneva processes. Can you take us through those?
Yeah, well, first of all, in terms of ceasefires, the latest ceasefire is the third in a series that has been taking place over 1 year in Syria. And none of those ceasefires has actually managed to pave the way for meaningful peace talks. And there's actually a simple explanation for this, which is that Russia, primarily, has not been really interested in a peace process in Syria. And that's because it sees that it's doing quite well militarily at very low cost. And so the way I see it, if I were Russia, why would I want to compromise politically if I can win militarily? And Russia is relying on, some of its own troops on the ground in a limited kind of capacity, but a lot of mercenaries, militias that have joined the fight in support of the Assad regime. And these militias are either Syrian, such as the National Defense Forces, or militias like Hezbollah, which is a Lebanese group that has joined the fight, and some Iranian militias as well, and some Iraqis. So we have a very complicated situation, but Russia is finding this quite useful. So the latest ceasefire was simply a political statement by Russia to indicate that it is now the primary political player in this conflict. And this links us to the talks that were called by Russia to happen in Kazakhstan. Again, Russia said it is the host of these talks. It will choose who is going to be participating in these talks. And very notably, Russia eliminated the Syrian High Negotiating Committee, which until very recently was the representative of the Syrian opposition politically that had been taking part in talks in Geneva. Now, the difference between the Kazakhstan talks that may or may not happen, and the Geneva talks, is that the Geneva talks were called for by Russia and the United States with the blessing of the United Nations. The United States is absent when it comes to the Kazakhstan talks. The United Nations is also, absent.
So the Kazakhstan talks are, by and large, Russia and its allies talking to each other?
More or less, yes, because Russia says we want to talk to the opposition. However, we want to talk to the parts of the opposition that we feel are suitable.
Now, the big change, of course, in all this, which has gone Russia's way, has been the Turkish accession to the Russian camp.
Yes.
Now, this is a very big change, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a major change. At the beginning of the conflict, Turkey saw in Syria an opportunity. Turkey thought that regime change in Syria was possible, that it was a way for Turkey to increase its own influence in the region, in the Arab region. We saw collaboration between Saudi Arabia, Qatar and Turkey that led to the rebel groups on the ground doing relatively well. We're talking spring 2015 by the time this happened. And this alarmed Russia. And it's part of the reason why Russia increased its own intervention in Syria by starting an airstrike campaign and also starting to lead military operations on the ground. And meanwhile, Russia put a lot of pressure on Turkey economically, politically and security-wise. And Turkey at the same time found itself more or less abandoned by the West because the United States has been for a long time relatively turning a blind eye to what is happening on the ground in Syria. We are now beginning to understand that Syria has not been a real priority for the United States. Regime change in Syria has not been a priority for the US. So Russia took advantage of this. And Turkey, meanwhile, found itself with no Western backing and with a lot of pressure by Russia. And in a way, for its own national security's sake, it had to just, get closer to the Russian camp.
And finally, when we look at the kind of the geopolitical actors in this, it's not clear to everybody why the Iranians would be so bothered about what's happening in Syria.
Oh, Syria is very important for Iran. Syria is obviously geographically between Iran and Lebanon. And Syria is where Iran used to funnel weapons to Hezbollah in Lebanon through. And Syria is where Hezbollah used to train its troops. So Syria and Iran have had a strategic alliance, largely because of Iran's geopolitical ambitions in the Middle East. And so if Syria were to change regime and the new regime were to be not as friendly to Iran, then Iran will lose the supply line to Hezbollah in Lebanon. And this is a key issue. And also Syria is where Iran also was able to mobilize in order to exert pressure on Iraq, which is also, as we know, bordering Syria. So Syria is strategically very important for Iran. And that's why Iran has been doing all it can to retain some sense of influence in Syria. First of all, it did this by trying to support the Assad regime as much as possible, which it continues to do. However, now, in addition, it's also trying to do this from the ground up through supporting these various militias on the ground.
Lina Hatib, thank you. Aaron Lund is still with me. What do you think the next 1, 2, 3 years holds for Syria?
Well, I think I disagree a little bit with Lina's take on this, because I do think the government recapturing eastern Aleppo is the turning point. The government was doing quite well already. And after Aleppo, I think these trends you've seen with Turkey sort of taking a step back, as Lina described, and perhaps other countries doing so as well, are likely to accelerate. And that will hurt the opposition a lot, I think. So, you know, my sense is that the opposition has more or less lost the war. The question is, can Assad win it? You know, is anyone at this stage strong enough and cohesive enough and has enough backing and resources and allies and money and so on to retake all of Syria? I'm not sure Assad can do that, even in the best circumstances.
Well, can we explore him, what that actually means then? Because the suggestion, are you talking about a continuing low-level insurgency in which Assad controls most of Syria? People get killed all the time. It's a source of continuous instability, but there's no prospect of the Syrian rebels actually winning. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, neither rebels nor the regime, I think. That's the question. I think this has been kind of a lame duck insurgency for quite a while. You've had groups that were strong enough and motivated enough to ownership of the insurgency and perhaps even take over Damascus if they'd been left alone to do that. And for example, the Islamic State, but the rest of the world, the United States and the United Kingdom and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and others, have been blocking that. They've been stopping that from happening because they don't want the Islamic State in control of anything in Syria. So the rebels that are backed by the West and by these other governments and by Turkey, I don't think that segment of the insurgency has had a chance to win for a long time. And that is becoming obvious now because it doesn't have the capacity, it seems, to govern Syria. And so the United States, for example, hasn't been interested in seeing those rebels actually taking over Damascus or even Aleppo. So what they've done is they've backed these rebels in the hope that this, you know, adding enough pressure on Assad can force him to negotiate a solution where he would share power, he would step aside or something. But the Assad government has shown time and time again that it's not interested in those negotiations. It won't, you know, it'll perhaps devolve some power, but Assad will not step aside.
In other words, it's will the ends, but not the means. And now you have President-elect Trump, who doesn't even will the end.
Yeah. So, I mean, with eastern Aleppo gone and Turkey shifting its position in various ways and Trump now in the White House, of course, we'll see what he does. I think all of those things are bad signs for the opposition. And taken together, 2016 was quite a horrible year for the Syrian rebels. The question for me is not whether the opposition can turn this around. I don't think they can do that unless something very dramatic happens, such as Assad dying or something like that. But the question for me is how much of Syria can Assad reconquer? And, for example, you have the Kurdish groups in northern and northeastern Syria, which have U.S. air support. Can he go up against that? Probably not. Can he take back enough of the east from the Islamic State and so on? Perhaps if someone else crushes the Islamic State for him. So the question for me is how divided will Syria be and how much of a low-level sort of underground insurgency will remain when Assad sort of stabilizes his control in the most populated parts of Syria?
It's not a jolly prospect for 2017. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Abdul Khafi, who we heard earlier, and to Aaron Lund, Lina Khatib and Marianne Gasser. The Briefing Room will be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. My producer for this episode was Hannah Sander. The sound engineer was James Beard. Research was by Kirsty Knight and Serena Tarling. We're always grateful to hear what people think of The Briefing Room. If you'd like to let us know your views, there's an easy way to do it. Just leave a rating, or even better, a review on iTunes or your podcast provider. Thanks for listening.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.